Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. I want to acknowledge my own error on Barack Obama's birth certificate. That'll be the topic of today's show. I want to apologize to my audience for me erroneously thinking that Barack Obama probably did not have a Hawaiian birth certificate. In today's program, I'd like to talk through the issue and discuss the lessons that I want to learn from this. Now, what we have done is to give to Obama a perceived moral high ground from which his most vocal critics, including me and a number of my friends, are seen to be easily confused and even laughed at. Of course, they laugh at us all the time. But you don't want to give them an opportunity unnecessarily to laugh at you. Jesus is the rock of offense. The truth is unavoidably offensive, but you don't want to unnecessarily present stumbling blocks to other people. I want to compliment the caution of many conservative talk show hosts and others who have refused to be pulled into the growing list of details that led me and many to conclude that Barack Obama probably didn't have a Hawaiian birth certificate. I'd also like to talk about in this program that it is easy to be drawn into an invalid conspiracy theory, like the birth certificate, the moon landing, we never landed on the moon, the contrails, and so on, if you've heard of that. Why it's important to be able to admit when you are wrong. That should be obvious, but it's not done sufficiently often, so it seems that we don't really realize how important it is to admit when you are wrong. I'd like to talk about what to avoid when you acknowledge making an error. What do you avoid? Like, avoid apologies that are really backhanded insults. Avoid blaming the other person for your error. That happens constantly. I want to talk about those who say that this birth certificate that Obama released is not valid, that it had Photoshopped layers and things like that. I'd like to talk about staying focused on the fundamental moral issues, the things that God will bring up on Judgment Day. Those are the issues that I want to stay focused on, and there are a lot of them. I'd like to talk about the supreme law of the land, which the Constitution says are our treaties. You know that, right? I have so many friends who are obsessed with the U.S. Constitution, and they don't know that the Constitution says that our treaties are the supreme law of the land. They don't know that. Why is it that I know it and they don't know it and they're obsessed with the Constitution? Now, I have previously overstated this. I've previously, and this is another correction, said that the Constitution says that the treaties preempt the Constitution itself. It doesn't say that. In Article, what is it, Article 6? The Constitution says that our treaties are part of the supreme law of the land. The Constitution and the treaties form the supreme law of the land. Now, the Bible clarifies that even further. There's a lot of examples of the Constitution saying things that many of my friends who are obsessed with the Constitution have no idea that it says. I don't get that. Actually, I do sort of. The people who are radically pro-Constitution, they pretty much never read it because it's boring. It's boring. It's really hard to read. I mean, I've read it many times as a talk show host. I've had no choice. But most people who love it, people who carry it around in their pockets, they're the ones who've never read it. They've never read it. They carry it around, they give it to everybody else. They say, here, you should read it and then tell me what it says. So the supreme law of the land, the Constitution and the treaties, but how God's law trumps everything. God's law trumps everything. Doesn't matter what it is. And I'd like to talk about a man-made agreement like the Constitution when the parties to the agreement mutually ignore it and they don't care about it or about portions of it. When the parties to an agreement don't care, well, then what? What does that mean morally? And on Judgment Day, what will that mean? And about going forward from this point. So, how is it that it's so easy, not for everyone, but for many, to be drawn into invalid conspiracy theories? Now, I say invalid. That means the ones that I've decided are invalid. I call them invalid, right? Ultimately, objectively, the ones that God says are invalid, they're the ones that are wrong. I could be incorrect. You could be incorrect. God's not incorrect. So say the moon landing. Millions of Americans, even kids in public schools, have been shown videos by their teachers saying that we didn't land on the moon. And I have a dear friend who believed that. He heard it in school, and he believed it. And I had another young friend who heard it in school. He believed it. And I told him, when you're going to apply for a job, if it's an important job, whatever you do, if the moon landing comes up in the interview, don't say you think it was a hoax. Just don't say it. But my one friend, very smart, very sharp, and he was presented this, that the moon landing was not true. We took a whole day. We got videos from NASA. We got the documentary, the leading documentary that says we didn't land on the moon. And we got NASA photo book photos, like coffee table books of moon landing photos. And we got the Mythbusters program where they debunked some of the claims that we didn't land on the moon. And we went through it all. We spent a full day. And we took notes, and we were able to answer virtually all of the claims of those who say we didn't land on the moon. And this was to my friend's satisfaction that we answered virtually all the claims. Now, did we answer every last claim? No, there were a few questions left in our minds, but it doesn't matter what you look at. What do you have a complete understanding of? If you go to the town dump and looked at how the furniture is mixed up with the trash and you figure out, well, how did this table end up over that piece of trash and under that piece of trash? That's not possible. Must be a conspiracy. People must have planted that table in the town dump. Otherwise, this could never have happened. And I remember that. People say things like that about 9/11. How could this have happened? And I remember reading a book about Hiroshima and the atomic blast in Japan. And I was a kid in, I think, fourth grade. And I read a book about it. And one of the survivors described going to a building, an office building. Maybe it was his. I forget. And the building was destroyed. And sitting there where the office building was a briefcase, and it was open, and there were all the papers in the briefcase. And the building was destroyed, but the briefcase seemed unharmed, and all the papers were there undisturbed. And so this was no conspiracy thing. He was just describing the absurdity of what he saw. It's like seeing a house destroyed by a tornado, and there's a table, and on the table is a bottle of wine, and it's sitting there. It'd be like, but somebody could say, you realize, of course, that when an atomic bomb explodes, there's no way it could possibly leave a briefcase with papers undisturbed if the entire building is destroyed. You realize that, and you think, well, I'm not a stupid person, so of course I realize that. But you'd be wrong, because things happen in ways that are very difficult for us to then go back and interpret with 100% accuracy. So it's easy, once we end up with a bias, it's easy to be pulled in by multiplying details. It's easy. And to dismiss all contrary evidence and interpret everything to support your own theory. But you know what I like about the Bible? Jesus Christ and Paul, they both show the courage of intellectual integrity by inviting people to consider the possibility, theoretically, that they may be wrong. And Jesus said in John that if he testified concerning himself, his testimony is not credible. He said, because everybody lies. So just because a pilot says, oh, I saw a UFO flying over the Capitol, it doesn't mean he did, because everybody lies. So Jesus said, you need to not only look at my testimony. And Paul said that if Christ did not rise from the dead, then the Christian faith is false. So these things show courage and intellectual integrity, and I admire that. So why is it important to be able to admit when you are wrong? Well, credibility, of course. When I'm wrong, I lose credibility. When you're wrong about something, you lose credibility. There's nothing you can do about it. But if you don't admit that you're wrong, then of course, we all know this, right? You lose even more credibility, at least with people who know right from wrong and people who could see. I mean, people who are gullible, who you're duping, they might not get it. But with the people that you really should care about their evaluation of you, with them, you're going to lose even more credibility. And even among your friends and family members. And then there comes a point when you cross a line and when you continue to believe something against strong evidence that you have been wrong. And when you cross that line, then bad things begin to happen in your own mind, in your social circles. It's like becoming inbred and insulated from reason and from valid criticism. God says, come, let us reason together. Come, let us reason together. And I notice how evolutionists, they cannot falsify their theory. They can't, theoretically, they can't say, well, if this was shown to be the case, then evolution is false. They can't do that. They're afraid to do that. The Apostle Paul said, if Christ did not rise, then Christianity is false. That shows intellectual courage. So when I apologize, and I think about this often because you hear Christians, a lot of our Christian leaders, they have on their calendar, on Monday, issue a press release, and on Wednesday, issue an apology. I mean, it's automatic. It just happens constantly. Whenever they say anything really good, then they apologize. Franklin Graham, who did he endorse? Pro-abortion, Donald Trump. Pro-homosexual marriage, right, Franklin Graham. So, but our Christian leaders, when they do something really bad, then they don't apologize, then they defend themselves. When they do something good, then they apologize. It just goes that way. So, but when, what to avoid when we acknowledge an error is backhanded insults. I never say, I'm sorry that you were offended, or I'm sorry if you were offended, or I'm sorry if I offended you. That's just an insult. You're just saying, look, I know that you're so stupid that you didn't understand what I said, and so now you're all angry about it, and I'm sorry that you're stupid. That's what it is. I'm sorry that you're stupid. It's like the mom who tells her son, go tell your brother that you're sorry what you said. And he goes and he says, I'm sorry that you're stupid. That's an insult. Backhanded insult. Also, don't blame the other person for your mistake. Like, I was wrong, but Obama made me do it. I was wrong, but Obama baited me into it. You know, why didn't he release this 2 years ago? Well, sure, he could have done that, but if the other party has blame also, let that stand on its own. when we apologize, that's not the best time to criticize the other party. It's just not. It falls flat. It falls flat. And those who say this birth certificate is not valid, right? For example, it has Photoshop layers. And actually, you don't see the layers in Photoshop. You see them in Illustrator, maybe some other programs. And that's true. You look at the PDF file. What does PDF stand for, everybody? Everybody says PDF file. Portable document format. A file that you could look at an image on many different kinds of computers and browsers. So you look at this PDF, and with Adobe Illustrator, you see that it has layers, and you could click and turn the layers on and off. So you turn off the green background of that official green pattern of horizontal and vertical lines that are in some government documents, and you turn it off, and now you see all the typewritten and signatures. And then you click somewhere else and some of the signatures disappear. You click somewhere else and some of the text disappears. And people said immediately, well, look, this is not a real birth certificate that was scanned. This is a document created in Photoshop. And there's all the layers. Now, here at Bob and Yurt Live, we create a lot of labels and documents, including for DVDs and CDs and books. And we use Photoshop and Adobe Illustrator. And normally, to pull off something like that, you do it in Photoshop. You could use either tool, but Photoshop. But the layers, you can't see the layers in Photoshop, but you see them in Adobe Illustrator. And here's why. Scanners break up images into, well, for one, three primary colors. And they also break up images into text that the computer can try to make out what is this text saying, so that then you scan a contract, you put it on your computer, and then you search and you could find a phrase in your contract. Say the contract is 80 pages long. So it's called OCR, optical character recognition. That technology has been around for decades. And so many scanners will scan in an OCR mode where it's breaking up the image into different pieces that the computer is trying to figure out. Is this part of the background? Is this part of a graphic, or is this some text? So if some letter is being typed and it's more blurry and the other letters are typed and they're more clear, it might think the blurry one is part of the background and the clear ones are part of the text. So it'll create it in different layers. And so that's obviously what happened when someone scanned Barack Obama's birth certificate. It ended up in these layers that you can separate and look at. There are criticisms, for example, that Barack Obama's father, instead of saying that he was black, it says he's African. And they said, you know, that Obama was born in 1961, and it wasn't until later in the 60s when it became common to use African as a race, like African American. And that, when that change in terminology happened, it didn't happen on a dime. It didn't happen out of thin air. It was part of a movement, an African identity movement by intellectuals and college types. And Barack Obama's father was intellectually part of that movement. And so he's at the hospital, if he is, or his wife. And they say, well, how about the father's race? And they say, he's African. And they say, all right, black. And they say, no, not black, African. Put African. And so the nurse, the clerk, puts African. So there's no end, though, to the questions that could be raised about absolutely anything. Somebody could argue that broccoli is really the salvation of the world, broccoli. You think that's absurd? They do it with marijuana, right? Hemp. If you listen to the people who argue for the legalization of smoking pot, they want it to be legal to be a pothead. Well, then they say that if we legalize hemp, marijuana, we will solve the nation's difficult economy. We'll have almost 100% employment. We will end global warming. We will end our energy crisis. We will lower the cost of clothing. And they just go right down the line. It will solve all the problems of the world. And so it becomes an obvious bias. If you said broccoli is going to save the world, then you start looking at the dictionaries that you have and encyclopedias, and you look up broccoli and you look up other articles that have the same words that the articles on broccoli have, and you could build a case that there's a conspiracy. They're trying to hide from us the truth that broccoli will save us. And you could write a whole book on it. I mean, that kind of thing is done all the time. And that's how people end up believing that we didn't go to the moon, because some creative people begin looking very carefully and looking at details, some things they don't understand, some things they intentionally misrepresent, like Michael Moore, and pretty soon you have an ironclad case. Like Michael Moore did his Fahrenheit 9/11 on how wicked George W. Bush is, and all he cares about is oil and money. Remember that? That documentary he did? And he said that from Saudi Arabia, and was it even part of Osama bin Laden's family, flew to America to discuss an oil deal, and they went to Texas. That's because that's where George W. Bush was, right, in Texas? What he didn't include in the movie, but what he knew, was that he flew to meet with representatives of the Clinton administration. That's what he left out. So he wants to make Bush look bad. So he says that they flew to Texas, making the viewer think he meant to meet with Bush, but he actually knew he met with Clinton. So it's so easy when my friends send me things, an email, and say, look at this. When it supports my case, I try to doubt it. Be suspicious. Don't trust what people say. Check everything out. If your mother says she loves you, check it out. So then the issue of being brought over to focus on whether or not Barack Obama was born in Hawaii. Now, it's so important to stay focused on the fundamental moral issues. I think we should have secure borders in America. But when we get to heaven, God is not going to judge anyone on whether or not they allowed Mexicans to come into America without going through the right process. That's not going to be high on God's list of things that he's concerned about. It's just not. The fact that we look the other way, the government, and let Mexicans come into our country, and then we try to sell them abortions, that gets God angry. But so you try not to major in the minors. So you stay focused on the fundamental moral issues that God will bring up on Judgment Day. So to the extent that the Constitution speaks of fundamental moral issues, like you cannot deprive someone of life without due process unless they've been convicted of a capital crime. So if the government is killing the innocent, then that's a fundamental moral issue that God will bring up on Judgment Day. Whether or not somebody in the Third Reich was born in Austria or Germany, it's not especially relevant. It's not going to come up on Judgment Day. It's not. Now, people say, oh, but the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and then they need to wash their mouths out with soap. Because, first of all, if they even believe that, which they don't, but if they did, you see, because whenever somebody comes up with anything other than God's law is the supreme law of the land, when they come up with anything else, what they really mean is my own opinion is the supreme law of the land. My opinion is what should reign supreme. Whenever somebody doesn't acknowledge that God's law trumps all, then what they're really saying is their own opinion should be supreme. So if they really believe the Constitution was the supreme law of the land, then they'd probably read it at least once. Then they'd find out that the Constitution says that treaties are the supreme law of the land, treaties. And so treaties. So my dear friend Alan Keyes has said, hey, natural born citizen, the Constitution says you have to be a natural born citizen. And that has been, that has never been officially defined as to whether or not many of the original founders of the country thought it meant you had to have two parents who were citizens, and you had to be born here with two parents who are citizens. Others may have thought maybe if you had one parent, then you're a citizen. But now, since then, we've had 200 years of treaties, and with our joining the United Nations. And sure, I hate the United Nations along with the best of you. But according to our Constitution, in I believe it's Article 6, that our treaties and the Constitution form the supreme law of the land. And there's something very valid there. In fact, the Bible puts it even more clearly that your treaties trump your in-house rules. Your house rules are trumped by the rules that extend to other people. That's the valid way of understanding that. That wherever our treaties contradict the Constitution, the treaties prevail. You might have your own rules how you do things. And when you enter into a contract with someone else, then that contract takes precedence. So let's say your own rule is you sleep in Saturday mornings. That's your rule. And then you enter into a contract where you agree to cut somebody's lawn. It has to be done by noon on Saturday. And now it's Saturday morning, and you say, well, I sleep in Saturday mornings. Well, that doesn't matter now because you entered into an agreement with another party, and that external agreement supersedes your in-house agreement. And that's what God shows in the Bible. We have a Bible study on that. So while treaties supersede the Constitution, God's law trumps all. And so those are the things that Christians should focus on, teaching people and advocating for things that are eternally important, not things that are incidentally important. Like, does it matter where Obama was born? Only because of the incidental quirk of what does that phrase mean in the Constitution. But it's not an eternal matter of right or wrong. If Hitler was born in Austria, not Germany, is it going to matter on Judgment Day? It's not going to matter. In a man-made agreement like a constitution, what about when all the parties mutually ignore it? If you have a contract with somebody and you no longer care and they don't care if you abide by it, then you're both mutually changing it. So as Christians, we got to think through, and I apologize for the birther thing.